Ronald Coleman is a distinguished professor of ethnic studies at the University of Utah. But 5 decades ago, he was a young African-American athlete eking out a living as a minority in Utah.
I envisioned myself at 21, which is when I started, of becoming the first African-American CEO of General Mills. The basis for that optimism came from what was being done on the backs and shoulders of the sheroes and heroes of the modern civil rights movement.
Today, on the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour, two perspectives of the civil rights movement from two distinct and distinguished University of Utah professors in the Department of Ethnic Studies, Ronald Coleman and Armando Solorzano. That's coming up, but first, here's this news. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. Today on the program, we are airing talks from two prominent University of Utah professors, two men who experienced the civil rights movement firsthand and who themselves faced legal, cultural, and social hurdles to realize equal rights and acceptance for their respective ethnic minority groups in Utah. Their talks were organized as part of the university's Martin Luther King Day celebration last week. In the second half of the program, we'll hear from Professor Ronald Coleman. Coleman has taught and worked at the University of Utah for 4 decades and has been a distinguished professor and coordinator of the Department of Ethnic Studies. He speaks about his life as a young African-American athlete attending school in Utah in the early 1960s. We'll hear from him in the second half of the show. Now, I'm going to let Cindy Berg, the Dean of the College of Behavioral Sciences, introduce the first speaker, Professor Armando Solorzano. Again, this was recorded last week at the University of Utah on January 20th, 2016.
It's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Armando Solorzano, who is an associate professor in the Department of Family and Consumer Studies and Ethnic Studies at the University of Utah. He has published really extensively and contributed to our understanding of Chicanos and Latinos in the state of Utah. His work really emphasizes the role of religion in immigration, education, family formation, and Latino cultural religious identity, some of the really big topics I think you've tackled. The Utah Division of State History gave a meritorious book award to Dr. Solorzano for his book, We Remember, We Celebrate, We Believe, Latinos in Utah. This bilingual and ethno-photo history provides a foundational contribution to our understanding to really what's a sparse literature on Latinos in Utah and covers really a number of important topics, including the long history of Hispanics in the state of Utah, strong early Hispanic communities, Latinos as Utah workers, miners, railroad laborers, and migrant agricultural workers, the place of religion and spirituality in this diverse and distributed Utah community, and the quest for civil rights. In his 22 years of teaching here at the University of Utah, Dr. Solorzano has taught a variety of classes, and I think some of your students are in the room today, that goes from sort of the epistemology to the Chicano civil rights movements. Every semester he teaches the class Ethnic Minority Families in America, which encompasses the families of the 4 traditional ethnic racial groups in the U.S. And in the summer he teaches a summer abroad program in Mexico or Costa Rica. His research is, I think, really unique in taking a qualitative methodology, relying on primary sources, such as oral history interviews, participant observation, and ethnophotography. The underlying intention of this research, I think, goes beyond the publications and includes the creation of databases and documentation that can be used in future work by scholars and community leaders, which is just a real gift, I think, that he's given our community. So I will now let Dr. Solorzano speak.
Thank you so much for inviting me to be part of this celebration. When I saw my picture in the poster with Martin Luther King, I had to cry because he has been my role model. He has been my English teacher where I grew up. That's how we were taught to learn how to speak English, mainly through his speech on I Have a Dream. And since that day, I decided that I was going to talk like him. Guess what? A failure. Thank you for inviting me. What I'm trying to do, and again, because we don't have much time, is to start very briefly on Martin Luther King's contributions, then move on his influence on Cesar Chavez, one of the biggest leaders of the Chicano civil rights movements in this country, and then address the issue of the legacy of Martin Luther King and Cesar Chavez in the Chicano civil rights movement in Utah. Yes, we did have a Chicano civil rights. And according to some academicians, it was the most successful civil rights movements in the nation. However, I challenge my colleagues on this theme and see how far we can go. Again, I believe we will not be able to cover the whole presentation, but I will try to do my best just to incite some interest and also admiration for what is happening in our own state. Martin Luther King was a visionary, a prophet, that chose nonviolence in a country that prefers military men or politicians for the task of leading a revolt or social transformation. He lived in Upper High USA that discriminated against the citizens on the basis of the color of the skin. Since very young, Martin Luther King said, "I don't care how long I have to live with this system, I'm never going to accept it. I will oppose it until the day I die." That's why I refuse any invitation to talk about Martin Luther King when I'm told and asked that I should present Luther King as a saint, as a martyr. Mainly, they are basically asking me to ignore the circumstances that forced Martin Luther King to struggle for a better society. Issues like the Civil War, the period of slavery, systematic racism, and the dehumanization of the people of color should not be put under the rug. When people ask me to tell a good story about Martin Luther King, they don't want me to mention that Martin Luther King was stabbed 3 times, physically attacked 3 times, bombed his house 3 times, and put in jail 14 times before he was shot to death in 1968. This is the first time that I accept an invitation to talk about Martin Luther King. And people who invite me to sanctify and to put in a pedestal to Martin Luther King are asking me not to remind you that if there is not a struggle, there is no progress. That people in power concede nothing without a demand. If we are to get rid from oppression, we might pay the price for its removal. Mainly people don't want me to tell you what Martin Luther King said one day: "Today is the day for the people of color to save this nation." Martin Luther King did not invent the struggle for civil rights. He inherited. His success in his prophetic vision was his passion for articulating for people the very foundation of hope, faith, and optimism. He reinterpreted the Exodus in the Bible, the Sermon on the Mount, and the story of the Calvary, and transformed them in a social gospel where he found that God was not only in him, but in his enemies. He profoundly admired Mahatma Gandhi, who in 1929 sent a message to the American blacks in this term: "Let not the 12 million Negroes be ashamed of the fact that they are the grandchildren of a slave. There is no dishonor in being a slave. There is dishonor in being a slave owners. Let us realize that the future is with those who will be in could we be truthful and loving? From here, Martin Luther King got the whole inspiration for his struggle. His struggle was not only for the black people, but it transformed the nature of the American society. One of the biggest impact on was on the Chicano civil rights movement, whose leader was Cesar Chavez. The Mexican Americans, who with other leaders, transformed also the national politics of the nation. And just as Dr. King was a disciple of Gandhi, we must know, we must be disciples of Dr. King. With Cesar Chavez, he advocated the struggle for social justice as it was applicable to farm workers and Mexican Americans. I don't know how many of you have heard of Cesar Chavez. He was the son of farm workers, but he attended 27 different high schools and he never graduated. However, he wrote the most powerful letters and documents for the cultural and spiritual renewal of the United States and the creation of a new social order in America. As Gandhi was inspired for Martin Luther King, Martin Luther King was an inspiration for Cesar Chavez. His movement and tactics include nonviolence, the ethics of self-sacrifice, and redemptive suffering. The problem that Mexican Americans and migrant workers face was due certainly to discrimination. The main goal of his movement was to eradicate racism and to rehumanize the Mexican Americans in the eyes of the European Americans. For Cesar Chavez, racism was just a mythology. In his own word, racism is originated in a modern mythology of a revealed human hierarchy where people of color occupy the lowest rung and are treated as wards of and servants to the master race. Racial superiority is effective discursive practice that justifies the enslavement of black and brown people by asserting a natural and biblical order of creation. And as you can see, him as Martin Luther King put religion in the middle of the struggle. Cesar Chavez was bringing religion and spirituality within the civil rights movement. And in fact, academicians and analysts affirm that Cesar Chavez script a political spirituality and a spiritual mestizaje that completely redefined the notion of politics and religion in the United States. This was not out of place because 30 years before, Gandhi once wrote, "Those who say that religion has nothing to do with politics do not know anything about religion." The movement of Cesar Chavez and his continuous hunger strike was capable of negotiating the mythologies of race and religion, of redefining the concept of work and work ethics in our country, of introducing female goddesses into mainstream society, such as the Madonna or the Virgin of Guadalupe, by introducing sacred stories and cosmologies of the Native American and the Mexican American Indian into the United States religion. At the bottom, the struggle of Cesar Chavez became a civil religion that proposed freedom, liberty, justice, and equality. His movement was a conversation of daily racism and involved the whole nation
in a spiritual discourse about what it means to be human in the United States. While he was in a hunger strike in Delano, California, Martin Luther King sent him a telegram. And he says, "I'm deeply moved by your courageous in fasting as your personal sacrifice for justice through nonviolence. My colleagues and I commend you for your bravery, salute you for your in the fight of work against poverty and injustice, and pray for your health and your continued service as one of the outstanding men of America. Our separate struggle, a real one, a struggle for freedom, for dignity, and for humanity. We are together in the spirit and in determination that our dreams for a better tomorrow will be realized." Martin Luther King and Cesar Chavez, they never met. They planned to meet 2 days before the assassination of Martin Luther King. The meeting never took place. I hope this foundation will help us to understand where we are going to go with the movement of civil rights in the state of Utah.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. Professor Armando Solorzano is an associate professor in Family and Consumer Studies and Ethnic Studies at the University of Utah. He spoke last week as part of the university's Martin Luther King Day celebration events. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. On this program, of course, we broadcast many engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and we replay them, mostly in their entirety, as a public service. And today we are airing 2 talks given last week as part of the Martin Luther King Day celebration by 2 distinguished professors in the Department of Ethnic Studies. Continuing with his talk, Professor Armando Solorzano spoke about the Latino civil rights movement in Utah that took place in the 1960s. It was a movement that he says was largely overlooked.
Where this movement come from, we understand we need to portray the economic conditions and contributions of Mexican Americans to this state. Again, I will not go into detail, but this is a map where we track that about 68% of all people who built the railroad in Utah were Mexican Americans. Okay. In people, like Bingham Canyon, right, 86%, even in 1940, were Mexican Americans. Okay. That gives you an idea. We were called to bring about the dream of Brigham Young. Brigham Young was to build the largest sugar factories in the United States. That's why we have Sugar House. But they didn't know how to do it, so they called Mexicans, but Mexicans don't do miracles, they just work in the field, right? So the civil rights movements in this, oh my goodness, I think I'm missing something very interesting. It's a picture, or hopefully it will come later. But this is the situation, so Mexican Americans that gave the origin to the movement. 68% of Mexican Americans dropped in high school. Okay. They were segregated in the west side of Salt Lake City. Okay. Situation that hasn't changed yet. If you go to Lincoln Elementary School, 98% of all kids in the west side are Latinos and students of color. Unemployment rates for Mexican Americans in the state was 11%. Chicanos at that time make 7,800. Caucasians make about 10,500. And the salary of Chicanas was 2,300. Okay. Latinos were not represented in the political arena of the state. And on December 15, 1967, following the call of Martin Luther King, 200 people, predominantly Mexican Americans, congregated in the Guadalupe Church and start organizing to improve the conditions of 50,000 Chicanos living in the state. They created an organization, it was called Socio. And what is important to us is the composition of the leadership of the movement. Okay. Utah is very different to any other state because the overwhelming presence of the LDS people. In that composition were Orlando Rivera, who was the first Chicano professor in this university. He was an LDS. He was a person with a prophetic vision. Then Bill Gonzalez, a professor also in the English department in this university. Bob Nieves, who was a Puerto Rican. Jorge Silarreta, who was a Peruvian. So as you can see, it was not really a Chicano movement, but the coming together of people of different nationalities. The goals of the movement have better access to education. But that time, there were only three minorities in Utah system of higher education, and they were at the University of Utah, three. They cannot come to university, to institutional higher education because of the high dropout rates. So the idea was to improve the educational status of Mexican Americans. Incorporated into the labor force of the state, housing integration. And that you can still track in what we call the East and the West divide. What is the marker? The railroad tracks. And it's highly visible. Political representation. Healthcare for the elderly. Elimination of mistreatment of the juveniles and Chicano inmates. But this time, the population was not even 1%. And we knew that 40% of people in jail were Mexican American. Something was not working. And improving the conditions of migrant workers. You know who they are, right? They come every year from April to October. There are about 25,000 people who come, work, you know, picking up cherries or onions, and they leave. At this time, migrant workers, the salary of migrant workers was less than the income that people receive from social welfare, in spite of the fact that they work 50 hours a week. So something needs to be done in Utah for this population. Tactics and strategies of how we are going to go about it. The first principle, non-confrontation, no violence, no threatening. Why? Because in Utah, we don't use those political measures. In Utah, all of us are nice. All of us are happy people. All of us can negotiate. So no bus strike, no boycott, right? No strikes on high schools, no stones on windows. Everything has to be to no violence. Then the second one, to adapt to the idiosyncrasy of a state overrepresented by LDS people. What do we mean by that? That since the very beginning, Chicanos decided not to use the word Aztlan. You know what it means, right? For us, this is our homeland. This is Aztlan. This is the land that the God gave us. But we agree, some Chicanos agree that they were not going to use it because it conflicts with the mythology of Utah, which is what? Zion. Didn't God tell Brigham Young that this was their land? How can you deal with two mythologies at the same time? That by itself creates the sources of conflict. So the sources of the Chicano civil rights movement in the nation was eliminated in Utah. So we don't have grounds. We admitted that there was another God who told us that this was their land. So that completely was taken out of the project. no connections with other movimientos in the nation. Because again, for the civil rights movements, we need to deal with legislators, with politicians, who at that time, 100% of those political bodies were represented by LDS people. So again, the first request, you don't need to ally with Corky Gonzalez or with Tijerina in New Mexico, right? Or with any leaders in the nation. We have our own leaders. The elimination of Aztlan as a unifying concept and to work with a democratic existing organization rather than to create new ones. Okay. This is important because we can see that the movement was successful, but I don't think it lasts long. It was not institutionalized. The leaders of the movement, Orlando Rivera, some of you met him, probably Professor Francis, you were here at that time. He said, in terms of the realization of the Chicano civil rights movement, Utah is ahead of California, Colorado, New Mexico, Texas, and Arizona. And I think that anyone who will argue otherwise is not really cognizant of what is going on. Why he was saying this? Because remember, we said that by 1967, there were only 3 minority students in the whole system of higher education at the University of Utah. By 1975, we got 700. Imagine the increment. So we try and compare our movement with other states at the national level, and we came out to be at the top of everybody. And then became the issue of how do you do it? How do you approach it? And other Chicanos did not take our struggle because, again, we didn't use the main concept that they were using at the national level. Why was he saying this? Because out of the 11 universities and colleges in Utah, only in the University of Utah we have ethnic studies. We established ethnic studies, Chicano studies, African American studies. So there was a reason for optimism for what we have achieved.
Well, a link to more of University of Utah Professor Armando Solorzano's talk can be found on our website, kcpw.org, on the page for this program. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. Now, on the program, I'm going to play a segment from Professor Ronald Coleman's talk from last week. Ron Coleman is one of the founders of the university's original Ethnic Studies Department. Coleman was also a distinguished University of Utah running back for the U's football team in the mid-1960s. Again, here's Dean of the College of Behavioral Sciences,
Dr. Coleman,
Cindy Berg,
and I have been at this university for a long time. We're not going to say how long, but he held the position of Associate Vice President for Diversity and Faculty Development and did so much on this campus for really raising the bar, raising all of our awareness, and really being a leader and mentor in this way. His research is in this area. He's an alum of our college in sociology, and I could go on and on, which I was planning on doing, but I'm going to stop and let him talk. So,
one of the mantras which I've come to believe very much in is the fact that none of us gets through our life journeys alone. And certainly, I've had so many sheroes and heroes who paved the way for me. And part of that began in 1963 when I first came to the University of Utah on an athletic scholarship. And since it was at the end of January and the winter quarter had begun, I wasn't enrolled in regular school. It was a chance to work. The athletic department found me a job. They didn't give me any money, but for $2.32 an hour, I loaded boxes at the Safeway warehouse, which was located on 2nd South on the west side. And if I never see a case of Campbell's soup again in my life, it'll be all right with me. My roommate and I, Andrew Ireland, Andy, we did take a couple of classes. Library science, since that was the biggest library that I'd ever been in when I first came on campus. And we took political science. We were fortunate in that we were the only two students in the course. And we had a professor who I met in 1963 and still claim as a very important friend and hero in my early development here, Dr. Dan Jones, and he's here. So, Dan, thanks. We were all a lot younger then, but Dan was very important in terms of becoming our adjustment to life in living in Salt Lake City. Both Andy and I were from California. And so I came to Salt Lake in February, I think, of 1963. It was not the school of my choice, but the coach that recruited me, I guess I would have gone to Timbuktu with him. He made a commitment to my parents that he would help them to help me to grow up to be a man. I was 18 years old. And last year we had a reunion, and he said, when I made that commitment to Ronnie's parents, I didn't think it was going to be 4+ decades. And he's still there and still helping me when if I need it, providing counsel. When I came to the University of Utah, then as I understand now, there was a limited number of students of color, particularly African Americans. In fact, I would say there were more African American student athletes on campus, more African American students on campus than any other population. This is a sad commentary, but that was in 1963. Most of the African American students were athletes. And in my time as an undergraduate student at the University of Utah, it was a wonderful experience, especially on the academic side. But I always felt that we really wasn't a part of the larger student body. We went from playing football, which I did in high school and community college, because it was fun, to working football. It was a job. You didn't have an option as to whether or not you went to practice, which you had in high school. And we were successful as a team our second year. And in the course of my undergraduate experience, I met some extraordinary teachers across the university. I'm thinking primarily of a political science class I had, and it's, one of you will help me. He went on to become very, very important in Latter-day Saint leadership. He was the vice president. Neil Maxwell. Professor Maxwell was extraordinary in his command of the classroom. And I usually took a C, but I studied in his class. I studied in his class because he was inspiring, and also there was a fellow in the class whose father was a supporter of mine as a vice president for Kaiser Industries, and I didn't want him to tell his father-in-law that I wasn't a good student, so I worked enough to do B work. And I think as an undergraduate student, I was so focused on graduating, just graduating, and doing what it took to graduate. And that meant 183 quarter hours, majoring in a certain academic topic, C average, and most importantly, passing your comprehensive exams. I didn't worry about anything but passing the comprehensive exams. You all today do not have comprehensive exams. That exam was given for sociology in the Waldemar Reed Auditorium just down this hallway. That was the high point of my academic experience. And I decided that it was going to be the toughest exam I'd ever taken, so I decided I would do a dry run. And I, through the support of the athletic department, spent about 6 or 8 months using tutorial services to beef up and back my background and to supplement my knowledge. And then I went in with the idea, I'll take it this first time, and when I don't pass, I'll come back again and take it a second time. I had enough time. And much to my surprise and great joy, I passed the first time. Now, my children came to the University of Utah quite a bit later. And at least one of them had Dr. Jones. That's kind of embarrassing for me. Children taking classes with your former professors. Their experience, I thought, as an undergraduate student, was much more enriching than mine. Never in my undergraduate experience, with the exception of reading an excerpt from Frederick Douglass's narrative, did I read anything by or about an African-American author or topic. And so as I came to the close of my undergraduate experience, I recognized that there was a void, something that I was missing, and that if I had to get it, was going to get it, I would have to get it on my own. And so I started reading books by and about African Americans. And that awakened in me a former interest that I'd had ever since grammar school in history. The high school that I graduated from in San Francisco, all students were required to have a major. And I majored in history in high school. And I never thought of becoming a historian, except that when I knew I had to graduate, I knew I had to find a job, a career. And Johnny Gaines was a friend of mine. His dad was a probation officer. And I talked to Mr. Gaines about being a probation officer and what you could contribute. And I started pursuing social welfare that led me to sociology. And here at the University of Utah, I met Dr. Ray Canning. Dr. Canning was my professor for social research and statistics. For years, I have nightmares about chi-square. But in the sociology department, Dr. Canning was there, and he spent the extra time outside of the classroom, which was right down the hall here in Orson Spencer, just really helping me fill in where I was running short. And I really appreciated the work and time that he gave. He's probably the most important faculty member I had in terms of the sociology department. I also met Dr. Philip Sturgis. And I'm giving you these names because I think part of the undergraduate experience, one of the most important things that undergraduate students could do, can do, and should do, is to make sure that you find two or three minimum professors who know you and know you very, very well. Well enough to write a special letter on your behalf in support of whatever it is you want to do. And so Dr. Canning was the person that did that for me. And when I pursued my first career job as in the aftermath of working for graduating from the university, he wrote that letter. And I ended up, not because of him, but with his help, and primarily through the National Urban League. I don't know if you've ever heard of the Urban League. Most of us here are the NAACP. But in the civil rights struggle in the 1950s and 60s, there were two major organizations in addition to the student organizations. The NAACP, which was primarily in the legal arena, and the National Urban League, whose efforts primarily were in education and, most importantly, employment. And when I graduated from the University of Utah, I thought I had a military obligation, and so I went to work for the city and county. I went to work for San Francisco Unified School District as a custodian. And my mother was not happy. And she, rest her soul, she was on my case, and that's being nice. And she told me, she said, you need to go down to the Urban League and see what see if they'll help you. And in order to appease her, I went to the Urban League, and subsequently, they became my placement center. They sent me on a numerous job interviews, and I ended up finding employment with General Mills. I don't know if any of you are familiar with General Mills, but Cheerios, Wheaties, Bisquick, Gold Medal Flour, we had a line of products. And I enjoyed that job. I envisioned myself at 21, which is when I started, of becoming the first African-American CEO of General Mills. The basis for that optimism came from what was being done on the backs and shoulders of the sheroes and heroes of the modern civil rights movement. I always have considered myself to be a beneficiary of what they did. And I've got that job. I really saw myself being in Minneapolis within, who knows, a very short period of time. Well, I didn't think that I would only be with them for less than 2 years. And I learned a lot and knew about overt forms of racism. You know, we all have experienced it or know of it. You can identify it. But what I was quite unaware of and certainly naive as to the notion of institutional racism. And so we were in a sales meeting in your hometown, Professor Francis, Sacramento, California, at the Arden Inn, off of Arden Boulevard, Sacramento Inn, on the second floor. I think I could find that room. I haven't been there since 1967. And our business was down. In sales, you're only as good as, where's the business? That's all they want to hear. And our bonus was based upon our collective record for the year. And so Jack Rothermel, I don't know that he's alive, and if he is, God bless him too. He was our regional manager, Northern California zone. He was giving us hell. And he said in the course of his remarks to us that day, some of you have gotten fat, sassy, nigger rich, and you don't know how to work anymore. And when he said that, I went into denial mode. And then, you know, I knew what he said. I'm 21, 22, yeah. First job, I don't even have a car, I have a company car. I'm totally dependent on keeping this job. But, you know, I had to be true to myself before anyone else. And so I got up and I started out of that room and he told me to sit down. And we had an exchange, a very quick exchange. And I left, and I got a call from my district manager. He wanted to come by and see me and said that Jack wanted to ride with me the next day. And he never apologized, but in his mind, I guess the incident didn't happen. But I'm slow, but I'm not stupid. And I talked to my roommate that night. And then the guy that recruited me to the University of Utah had left athletic coaching, had moved back to Sacramento, and was working with his dad. And I talked to him. And he said, what are you going to do? I said, well, it's clear, man. I can't stay here. I can't stay with him. But I got to pick my time. He said, yeah, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. He said, when do you think you want to go? I said, it's going to take me 6 months to pull my money thing together. And he said, well, I think you ought to go back to school and put something into the well from which you're drawn, which was education. And so by fall of 1966, 67, I was back in school and attending Cal State University, Sacramento. And in the course of a year, one of the most exciting years of my life, I had completed the California requirement for secondary education. And all along, I had been studying on my own African-American history, Lerone Bennett's Before the Mayflower. Then I got into the Book of Books, the great John Hope Franklin's From Slavery to Freedom. And I ran into a group of young cats, young brothers who were, some of whom were Vietnam veterans, and they were so much knowledgeable than I was. And they were at community college. I had a degree and felt that void, so I began hanging out with them and began to take advantage of some of the people who came to the Sacramento area and the Bay Area, and just began to grow by leaps and bounds, not in the terms of ego or anything. I knew who, I've always known who I was. But with a solid base of knowledge of from whence I come. I come from people who worked hard and were smart as anyone else. All they needed was a little opportunity. And in the course of that, I was able to fulfill Thomas Coleman's instructions. To get yourself an education is something that no one else can take from you. And I left the University of Utah with a degree in December of 1965, never to return. Never to return. I had a great experience, but I had never intended ever of living here. I thought life was difficult for African Americans. You didn't see them visible anywhere other than in the hotels or working as custodians. This appeared to be a place in lack of opportunity. And yet, my own personal awakening in civil rights came here in Salt Lake, primarily as a result of an African-American who was a PhD in anatomy from the University of Utah, and a faculty member in the College of Medicine, Dr. Charles Neighbors. Chuck Neighbors, he was a pain in my backside. But he was right. And for the first time in my life, I joined a picket line down at the what was in the church headquarters buildings on South Temple between Main and State Street. And that was over the lack of civil rights legislation in Utah. And you saw it. The All-American football player from the University of Utah was Roy Jefferson. And Roy and Candy Gordon, and Candy Jefferson, his wife, they had a new baby, and he had major problems finding a place to live. They used to have a little piece of housing over by the stadium called Stadium Village. And they lived there for a while before finding a little small place down on 400 South. It was tough. And so Dr. Neighbors, and then on campus, we were exposed to some things. I saw Dr. James Neighbor. I don't expect, but maybe a few of the faculty members to be familiar with the name of Dr. James Neighbert. Dr. Neighbert was best known probably as the president of Howard University. He had been dean of the law school and also a member of the NAACP legal defense team led by Judge Justice Thurgood Marshall. And he came to the university to speak. And the university at that time had a challenge week lecture series. And they'd bring individuals speak on same topic, different perspectives. And in the year that Dr. Neighbert came to campus, Governor Ross Barnett also came to campus. Now, I don't expect that anyone except for some faculty members would know who Ross Barnett was. But Ross Barnett was the next to George Wallace, one of the living political symbols of the segregated South and racial segregation as it existed. And so one week we heard one perspective, the other week you had another perspective. And I really just thought that was invaluable and part of the learning experience. Let me stop now, because I know some of you have got to get and ask me anything, and if I can't answer it or don't want to answer it, I'll let you know.
So yes. We'll devote the remainder of the time to questions. Please state your name clearly into the microphone.
I just wanted to say that I had Ron and Andy Ireland, but they never missed. But in 1964, in those days, you had a WT football team. You didn't have the split. You didn't have the split end and all that. And Andy was one halfback, and Ron was the other. But Utah got invited to its first bowl. Yeah, the Liberty Bowl, and they were up against West Virginia. And they went east to that bowl and weren't expected even to be in the game. And it wasn't going well until Ron Coleman made a 55-yard run and a touchdown, and Utah got the lead.
Let me give the historical record. We went there to win.
And
he's embarrassing me.
They won. And Utah won its first bowl, and they won over 11 games that year. But the thing I liked about him and Andy is they always came to class, and that they did not use it, abuse it, because they were heroes. But Ron Coleman, you're one of my heroes.
I should have known better than to give Dr. Jones the mic. Let me correct the record, though. We went 9-2. And we were the second University of Utah team to go to a bowl game. The first was in 1938, which was before even Professor Jones or I were born. So that's probably why we missed it. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. And if you have some extra money, be sure to go in your pocket. Dr. John Francis is going to lead by making a special donation this year to the Dan Jones Scholarship. Thank you, Dr. Francis and Leslie Francis.
I guess I have a question for both both Dr. Coleman and Dr. Salazano, which is you really are heroes, and you've seen a lot of change throughout time. What's your sage advice for going forward in terms of both representation at the university? What can make a big difference here?
You know, I can pretty much say anything I want now since I'm retired. Now, Armando's still got time to go. But I'm very concerned about the emphasis on image. And I wonder and hope that there is something substantive behind the concern about image. This institution, without the University of Utah, I would not have come to Utah and certainly would not have pursued the academic path or career that I have pursued. And so the school means a lot to me. And my big concern is that the school, as everybody talks about, you know, new advertising, your brand, that the institution becomes less focused on its mission of education and too much engaged in appeasement to donors and legislators. And I think we've seen a number of institutions across the country who have gone in different directions as they've hired their chief administrative officers. And I think it's lessened the core purpose of a higher education.
Again, that's Professor Ron Coleman, Professor of Ethnic Studies at the University of Utah. We have to wrap this up here, but if you're interested, you can find a link to this longer discussion with both Armando Solorzano and Ronald Coleman on our website, kcpw.org. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Ross Chambliss, your humble curator and producer of this program. Thanks for listening.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear, for the whole round world to hear. I wish I could share all the love that's in my heart. Remove all the bars that keep